Good morning, everybody. I have the wireless on. This thing is like the whoopee cushion for speakers. It is meant to embarrass anybody. You can't move that thing without...
It means collapses.
Yeah. How's that for deep philosophy? All right. Well, we've been talking, I'm sort of in the middle of a series. We've talked about the values that we got from the Bible. We talked about what some of the cultural values were in interpreting the Bible. We need to understand the cultural values. This is sort of the third part of my talk that I'm giving. This time we're going to talk about what the values that some of the values that we learned from the Bible, things that Jesus has taught us, other biblical authors have taught us, how have those values carried over into Western civilization, or not carried over, and what effect do they still have on us now? Where do ideas come from? Core ideas, values that we all have. Ideas like equality for all people, tolerance, forgiveness, liberty, civil rights, progress, individualism, women's rights, children's rights. These ideas in our culture just sort of seem to be in the air. Sort of a result of progressive thinking by intelligent people. But in this culture, and in this culture, it's natural to think, if we think about it at all, that these values are obvious, and anybody who really thought about it would adopt these same values. Yet these values were not held by most people in history. These values aren't held by most people in the world now. So where did they come from? Switch gears here for a second. Christianity and religion in general has sort of been taking a hit lately. There's books out there now that you can buy if you care to read what the other side is thinking. Books like God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything by Christopher Hitchens. The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. Here's some quotes by a couple of atheists that I thought would be interesting to read. The world holds two classes of men, intelligent men without religion and religious men without intelligence.
They never had you.
That's right. We're gonna talk about that this morning.
They were free, I think.
That's right. All the biblical miracles will at last disappear with the progress of science. Okay. We're all familiar. I found a website that had 101 great quotes by atheists, but I don't need to read them. What I want to talk about is the good part. There have been a lot of abuses by Christianity in the name of God. A lot of horrible, horrible things have been done. But what does being a Christian have to offer us in addition to salvation, in addition to a relationship with God? Are there things about our faith which are more cultural? And that's what I want to talk about. Christians, we're still, once we have a relationship with God, we still retain our own free will. We still retain our selfish nature. So we're fallible and selfish and sinful, and the church can still be motivated by power and control and greed and fear. But if the values that we find in the Bible are respected and followed, and this is what I want to talk about this morning, people, I want to make the case that people will be happier, more prosperous, more fulfilled, and more at peace, even if they don't have a relationship with God. And that those, the values that the Bible talks about are more powerful than any other value system. I know it's not politically correct to talk about a culture being better than another culture or value system being superior to another value system. But I want to try to, rather than just say that, I want to try to make a rational case for that this morning. I want to make a case for the idea that those values that I mentioned have their ultimate source in God through the pages of the Bible and our through our Judeo-Christian heritage. Some have taken centuries to develop. We're still figuring out what they mean. Some were obvious immediately to the followers of Jesus in the very first century. But these are not ideas that people come to naturally. I believe we only have them because of the Bible. Okay. Let's talk about one of these values. This is a value that everybody, you can say virtually everyone in this culture holds this value. Whether you are Christian, Jewish, Muslim, well, not Muslim, non-Christian, young, old, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, and that is the idea of the basic equality of all human beings. Now, that's not an obvious idea. If you really think about it, how can people be equal to each other? Some people are older, some are younger, some are stronger, some are more intelligent, some are better looking, some more look more, they don't weigh as much. Some people are more famous, some have better ideas. Some have had influence on history, others have not. So in what sense are people, what does it mean to say that people are equal? Now, before I ask you for your responses, I want to say one thing about, I'm going to do something sort of heretical in this talk, in this class, and that is that I want to try to limit questions. I want to try to get my idea out, and then I'm going to open it to questions, and then I'm going to go on for a little bit more. So I kind of want to do questions in like two or three sessions. But this is an open question to the class. What does it mean to say that all, like Jefferson said, all people are created equal? What does that mean? If it's not, it's certainly not from a Darwinian standpoint. So what is, tell me, somebody tell me what that means. Dan? And what is, how does that make us equal? Because you could say that some humans are better than other humans. So what does that mean? How, in what way are we equal? John?
I challenge the basic assumption.
Okay.
I think people believe that all people are equal. They say it, but they don't act like it.
Okay. Good. Norm?
We're in God's image.
Okay. And what is that, what does that mean?
Well, we have certain characteristics that, of God that take place in each human being. I don't know exactly what it means, but in some way we resemble God.
Okay.
Even the most humble looking person, we have to admit that in some way has the image of God's sense.
Jim?
Well, politically, I mean, we all have to be treated equally by the law.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make a law that discriminates between people because they're not somehow inferior or better or whatever.
But politically, that idea, and that's what I'm going to talk about next time, is all of this in politics. Politically, that idea came from the Bible. So it's based on
the fact that we are all created in God's image.
Right. Okay. Alan?
Would you say that we're all created equal? that God considers us, everybody, equal in His eyes.
So what is it about us that's equal in God's eyes?
Well, I mean, a guy could be better looking than another guy, but God doesn't see that. He just sees everybody.
So what is it He sees? What does He see in each of us?
Well, maybe He just sees the...
I mean, He knows you're better looking, but...
But he also needs glasses.
Oh, okay. Inalienable rights.
Okay.
We all are entitled to these rights as human beings.
Mm-hmm. But what makes us... What is so equal about us that we all deserve those rights? That's where I'm trying to go.
Heart and soul. In spite of our exterior conditions, we have
Okay. Christy?
God just placed that value on us. He made us. He created us. And he said we're valuable. And that's why he gave us our worth.
Okay.
And he shows no partiality. He says in the Bible, he shows no partiality. So
he knows shows no partiality. Rebecca?
Well, since created equal, so we all come from the same place when we're all born. You're born with a blank slate, and the circumstances determine what happens to you. And we all come in the same way, we all go out the same way.
That's one of the ones on my list is we're all going to be dead sometime. So that's a great equalizer. Things you said that's on my list is that we all have the opportunity to accept or reject a relationship with God equally.
Yes.
And that makes us equal. In, that's one of the things that makes us equal in God's eyes. John?
Yes. And we've got to not confuse qualitative and quantitative. We're equal in our personhood.
That's right.
Life. Our function may not be equal. Obviously, Solomon played a greater part, or David played a greater role in society than I am, at least up to this point.
Right.
So, function may not be equal, but personhood.
Yes.
Is equal.
I think that it's one of my notes here. We honor uniqueness, not uniformity. We acknowledge that God made us all different. Not the same, but that it's in that uniqueness that we're all, there's a sense in which we're all equal. Lee?
That statement, if you're using it from as a quote, is pulled out of context. You've got to know what comes before and after it. Once you see that, then it's back in context, I think.
What statement are you referring to?
All men are free to equal.
Okay.
In our...
Right. Al?
Just thinking of something that... God, or if we're all equal in God's eyes, or that type of thing, or well, basically, then how did it come about that the Jews are the chosen people? That makes the Jews almost seem special.
Well, to say that they're chosen, to say that they're chosen by God, which is true, does not make them superior. Okay, you're Alan. He's Al.
Al. Yeah. The Jews chose themselves. I mean, I'm the greatest in the world. I am, but to me, I am. But all men are created equal. I think that's true. We're all Homo sapiens from the same DNA. And what happens later on is what creates inequality. I mean, if you're born in a certain sect or a certain religion or a certain political thing, then you look at other people as not being as good as you, or being as good, or some better, or whatever. But we are all born equal, I think, because naturally, you know, it's a natural.
But what way, Al?
Huh?
In what way are we equal? How are we equal?
Well, when we're born with a brain.
Okay. So we're all human beings in that sense.
We don't have a brain, so,
okay. Barbara?
Well, I think that we are all different, but I think we all have value in God's eyes, and that's the humanity. That's what makes us want to treat everyone fairly. From the King David all the way down to the lowliest servant, they all have value in God's eyes.
Right. Okay, I'm going to take one more. Mara?
I think that God created us with a spirit as human beings, so He also created us and gave us a free will so that we could choose, you know, so we're equal in that way. And He died for all of us equally.
Yes.
Now, we're all equal in that life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, we have all of that stuff. But we're not the same functionally and everything else. And so we are all equal in God's love. We have an opportunity. He died for us and He gave us the spirit. He gave us our conscience.
Here's what I came up with. It's very close to what you're saying. We are all equal in that we all can sin and make mistakes. We're all fallible. We're equal in the sense that we all can suffer. We're equal in the sense that we all can die, or will die. We're equal in the sense that we all have the opportunity to reject or accept God. And nothing else that you nothing else that you can describe about people is as important as those things. So in that sense, we are created equal. Now I agree with you, John, that it is not in our nature I don't think we're built to believe that we're all equal. And that's what we have to fight against. God says we are. And so when I see somebody on the street that doesn't dress the way I think they should, or act the way I think they should, or they're the wrong color, and I go through what I go through in my head, we all have biases, I have to stop myself and say, no, he's a brother, he's a sister, he's a human being. Hang on, I'm done with questions for a minute. Okay, no, please. Okay, thank you. So I say that these, I'm going to claim that this idea came from the Bible. So I'm going to prove it or show you some verses. The main one is this one, Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. This is possibly one of the most powerful two verses, not only in the Bible, but in all of Western thought. Think about what that really means. It's easy to derive from that we're all equal. But there's another thing that's in here that's just as important, and that is the dignity of man. That human life is not cheap. Human life is not to be disregarded and not to be disrespected, which in much of the world, in much of history, life is cheap. Psalm 8:4 and through 6. What is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. Paul's famous statement in Galatians 3:28, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. That verse has had a huge impact on Western civilization. Jesus, in Matthew 12, then one said to him, look, your mother and your brothers are standing outside seeking to speak with you. But he answered and said to the one who told him, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And he stretched out his hand towards his disciples and said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. The great equalizer. Exodus 20:13, one of the Ten Commandments. You shall not murder. It doesn't say you can murder slaves or you can murder people that aren't in your tribe or your group. It just says, you shall not murder. It means God respects all human beings. There's a respect that he has for all humanity that we also must have. Let's talk about a little bit about what life was like in this environment before Jesus lived in the Roman and the Greek world. In Plato's Republic, he talks about people being of three kinds: gold, silver, and lead. Gold and silver were people who were political leaders, wealthy people, people of means, but people of lead were the common people, 90% of people. He said that most people have the soul of slaves and therefore deserve to be enslaved. When Christians... What's that? Plato. Yeah, I agree. If that got in the recording, you got to erase that out. Okay. When Christians arrived in Rome, they found a culture that did not value life equally. In fact, they did not value human life or the individual really at all. Let me read you another quote. The low view of human life among the Romans was one of their pagan depravities. The individual was regarded as of value only if he was a part of the political fabric and able to contribute to its uses, as though it were the end of his being to aggrandize the state. Okay, so that was the view that they had of the human being, the individual. Here's another one. Infanticide. Does everybody know what that means? The killing of infants. It was really widespread in Roman times. If you had a female child, or for any reason had a child that you did not want, there was no moral compunction about killing the child. It was just seen as an object. Now here we're talking about the cheapness of life. Cicero, a philosopher, a leader, he justified infanticide for the deformed. Seneca, his quote, "We drown children who at birth are weak or abnormal." Polybius, about 200 years before Jesus, blamed the population decline in ancient Greece on infanticide. Now, how widespread must it have been if the population was actually declining because of it? Also, infanticide is also common and still in many parts of the world. India, China, Japan, Brazil, the Eskimos, many cultures have practiced it. Now, Christianity believes in the sanctity of all human life. Based on the things that Jesus said, Christians took this stuff seriously and tried to change the culture around them. The Didache, which is an early Christian writing about 100 A.D., says, "Thou shalt not commit infanticide." So they were already fighting against it 100 years after Jesus. Christians fought against the practice until finally Valentinian, who was a Christian Roman emperor, based on his Christian beliefs, outlawed infanticide in 374. So it took almost 400 years to get that one small thing. Abandoning infants, that's another thing. It's almost the same as infanticide, although you could probably say it's not quite as bad. We'll just leave him alone. I'm not killing him, but, you know, I'm leaving him alone. Romans and Greeks both practiced this. It's mentioned quite a bit in Roman and Greek literature with no moral compunction connected to it. So apparently they didn't feel any guilt about doing this. Again, it was opposed by Christians. Clement of Alexandria, a church father in Egypt in the late 2nd century, he condemned the Romans for saving and protecting animals. I guess they kept pets and birds and that kind of thing. They would save and protect animals while lacking any moral feelings about abandoning children. Tertullian, a Christian author in around 200, he denounced the practice. Lactantius, another church father who tutored one of Constantine's sons, opposed it. His quote is, it is as wicked to expose as it is to murder. So here they're now finally equating it with murder. A 6th century canon of the church called parents who abandon their children murderers. It's also criminalized by Valentinian when he made infanticide illegal. And it was outlawed by King Magnus of Norway in the 11th century. Now, one of the things that's really interesting to me about all of this is how long it takes us to figure this stuff out. You know, here's this command, yet it takes us centuries to implement it to the point where we really accept it. The moral repulsion, the revulsion that we feel now, okay, for these kinds of things, whether you are a believer or not, is the result of a buildup over 2,000 years of internalizing these Judeo-Christian values that we have. Let me read. This is a quote from Peter Singer, professor of bioethics at Princeton. He says, "It may be worth remembering that our present absolute protection of the lives of infants is a distinctively Christian attitude rather than a universal ethical value."
Can you say that one more time?
I will. Peter Singer. "It may be worth remembering that our present absolute protection of the lives of infants is a distinctively Christian attitude rather than a universal ethical value." Wasn't
also Peter Singer who placed a higher value on a mature animal than on an infant?
Yes. So these are many of these quotes that I'm going to give you are not people who are believers. Okay, let's take a few questions. Mara?
He also believes that you should have the right to kill your child, even up to after the court.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And
personally, are we not doing infanticide today? Because now medically, you can kill it before it's born in the body. So it's the same. Look at how many babies are aborted. It's the same thing we're doing today. And Christians.
That's interesting. The next one I have on here, it says abortion. Al?
Yeah. All this morality that comes from the Bible. Even when Jesus was alive and walking around talking to people and talking about the kingdom of God, he was among slaves all the time, and he never prescribed it. He never said slavery is wrong.
Well,
it's witchcraft. They used to kill witches at that time.
We're going to get to slavery. That's one of the things on the list. John?
First of all, it was Christianity that ultimately got rid of slavery.
That's right.
But aside from that point, that arguing from an atheistic perspective, one has no right at all to state that something is right or wrong. From an atheistic viewpoint, one has no right to say Hitler was wrong in killing 6 million Jews. You may argue something conducive for society's benefit. Okay, don't go around murdering people. But ultimately, you cannot say it's right or wrong, because everything is a molecular accident. There is no intrinsic right or wrong in the universe. So if you cannot tell me I'm wrong if I go out and bash a 2-year-old baby's head. You can't say it's wrong.
Why not?
No, you can't. Because there is no ultimate right or wrong.
Morality did not start with God or the Bible. People started to get together and try.
Okay, John.
In the universe,
I agree with you, but we're going to go there later. One more statement question.
On abortion, a woman has a right to abort a child, but if someone kills a pregnant woman, they get him for 2 deaths.
Right. Yeah, the laws are contradictory. Okay, Alan.
Who is it?
Peter Singer.
When was he around?
He's just alive now.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Is he the son of Margaret?
So he kind of said that it was paradox or a dichotomy. He said one.
Well, he's not a believer, but he's acknowledging where the value came from. Okay, that's no. Okay.
Actually, I knew.
No, please.
I mean, I knew before that many years ago that no one will listen to me, but you will see how it will end.
Okay, let's go to abortion. Okay, Plato and Aristotle both had no compunctions against abortion. Abortion was really widespread in ancient Rome and Greece before Jesus. Before Jesus, though, the Jews had a moral compunction against it. They said that it was contrary, the Jews, contrary to the world around them, held to the sanctity of human life, even life in the womb. Flavius Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, said the Pentateuch, quote, forbids women from either to cause abortion or to make away with the fetus. Also, a woman who aborts her child destroys a soul and diminishes the race. Many early Christians denounced abortion. So, there again, the Christians are fighting the culture. Let's talk about the cheapness of life, okay, in that time. And I want to read something. I'm going to introduce these books to you as I go along, but I want to read something from one of them. It's a couple of paragraphs, so stay with it. But you'll just get the idea of how people treated each other in these times. While a few poets and philosophers oppose abortion, the Roman populace received adequate support from its morally decadent culture and from its morally depraved emperors who had no qualms about taking human life, young or old, prenatal or postnatal, Emperor Tiberius, who ruled from AD 14 to 37, so a contemporary of Jesus, and under whose reign Christ was crucified, loved to see tortured humans thrown into the sea. Emperor Caligula, about the same time, 37 to 41, the crazed tyrant who succeeded Tiberius, arbitrarily killed all who once served in his palace. He enjoyed seeing human beings dragged through the streets with their bowels hanging out, and he forced parents to witness the execution of their sons. Claudius, the successor of Caligula, treasured seeing the blood and gore of men brutally disemboweled in the Colosseum. Nero, who severely persecuted and executed hundreds of Christians, and he's the one who had St. Paul and St. Peter killed, forced Seneca, his former teacher, to commit suicide. Emperor Vitellius, a successor to Nero, who ruled only for 1 year, said that the smell of dead enemy soldiers was sweet, and the death of fellow citizens sweeter yet. That's the idea. That's what it was like. Okay. Let's talk about the gladiator shows. Gladiator shows were begun in Rome about 250 years before Jesus, and they lasted for 700 years. This was a high-ranking amusement. People felt no guilt or revulsion. They went to it like we go to the movies or a theater. People were died agonizing deaths. I have a description here, and I don't want to go into it. It's really disgusting. Hundreds, tens of thousands at least, people and animals died in the gladiator shows. And no one seemed to have a problem with it except the Christians. The Christians condemned, and they actually boycotted the gladiator shows. Now, here's a quote from let me read this quote. The games, as one historian noted, illustrate completely the pitiless spirit and carelessness of human life lurking behind the pomp, glitter, and cultural pretensions of the great imperial age. Minucius Felix cites a Roman pagan who strongly criticized the Christians for their anti-gladiatorial posture. Quote, "You do not go to our shows, you take no part in our processions, you shrink in horror from our sacred gladiatorial games." So the Christians were fighting it already at that time.
What year was that?
I don't know. It probably was around 100 AD. Author Jerome Carciopino says that, quote, "the butcheries of the arena were stopped at the command of Christian emperors." W.E.H. Leckie, anthropologist, says, "There is scarcely any single reform so important in the moral history of mankind as the suppression of the gladiatorial shows, a feat that must be almost exclusively ascribed to the Christian church." Okay? There's a lot of other things. Constantine, who was the first Christian emperor of Rome, he forbade the they used to tattoo the faces of criminals, and he thought that the face, that was hurting the image of God, so he forbade that. He also forbade men and women criminals from being held together in the same jail cell. And we think today, of course, you would hold them separately, but at that time, which was about 370 AD, there was no, if a woman was raped or abused, that's just too bad. There was no respect for people who were criminals. That even though they were criminals, they had some basic rights. That idea that we have, that's another one, comes from an interpretation of these ideas in the Bible. If we are all created equal, then there is a sense, even people who are criminals, that we all deserve respect. That is a biblical concept. And, well, I'll get to it. If you don't believe that, just look around the world. Look at cultures who have not had the Bible as their cultural background, and look at how they treat people. You look at human rights abuses in China. You look at things in the news. You say, how come they don't get it? Well, they don't get it because they weren't raised with it. It wasn't part of the culture. Okay? Okay. Let's talk about human sacrifice, Mayan and Aztec cultures. Some very graphic details. I'm going to read one of these. Referring to the gruesome religiously based human sacrifices of the Aztec and Mayan Indians, Hernando Cortez, the leader of the conquistadors, said that it was, quote, the most terrible and frightening thing he and his men had ever witnessed. Bernal Diaz del Castillo, one of Cortez's surviving soldiers, wrote that as part of the sacrifices, the Indians ate the flesh of the captured soldiers with a sauce of peppers and tomatoes. They sacrificed all our men in this way, eating their legs and arms, offering their hearts and blood to their idols. There was no moral compunction against that because they had no basic teaching against that in the first place. Now, I want to switch a little bit here because this whole episode with the indigenous people of Middle America, the Aztecs and the Mayans, it brings up a pretty sobering point for us in the church. Very frequently in human history, actions done in the name of God, which legitimately ended or restricted some evil, were themselves not done adhering to Christian principles. And this is where even us as Christians, we can say we're Christians, we have a relationship with God, but if we don't follow these ideas, we get in just as much trouble as the church does. And that's what leaves a mixed legacy for Christianity often, and room for a lot of fodder and criticism. This is a really good example of that. Cortez clearly did this partly for reasons of trying to convert the Indians and stop the butchery. Here's a quote here. Cortez, says Castillo, had as his mission, quote, putting a stop to human sacrifices, injustice, and idolatrous worship. Okay? So they had that in mind, but they kind of overdid it. They themselves killed thousands of indigenous people, tortured some through treachery, deceit, greed for gold. I read just an outstanding book that I'm reading, Guns, Germs, and Steel. And they said that Cortez took from the New World enough gold to fill a room 22 feet wide, 17 feet long, and 8 feet high. Now that must have been... That probably increased the world's gold supply, but it probably doubled it right there.
That was a Christian.
That's what I'm trying to say, Al. I'm trying to say that it was not a Christian thing to do.
Okay. There's something, too, that you left out. The Aztecs were just observing their religion. And
so we don't think that if part of their religion is sacrificing people and cutting them open and letting them and torturing them to death, that we're supposed to honor that? We are? Wait, we're supposed to honor that?
No, I'm not saying okay. They were religious people. So
yeah,
that's like saying
we're all political, therefore all political thought is equal. All religious thought is not equal, Al. Just because they were religious doesn't mean they were as right as other people that were religious. No, I don't agree with you. People are equal.
They used to kill babies so they could go to heaven while they were still babies.
Right.
And they had missionaries with them.
And that's part of what Cortez saw, and that's what he was fighting against.
It was very interesting. I always wondered how Cortez, with 300 men, was able to conquer this whole big nation. Because it was never in my textbooks when I was in school, when I went and studied that. What happened, obviously, of course, they weren't sacrificing their own people. They were going around, and the people around them, enslaving them, and taking them and sacrificing them. So Cortez, to win, all he had to do was to go outside of the city to all these people that had been persecuted for hundreds of years and say, I'm going to take down these people that are killing your people. And they all rallied. And so he had thousands of Native Americans that helped bring them.
Right, plus he had...
Standard guys with guns could not bring them to the empire.
Well, the technology helped. Okay, I'm going to take one more, and then.
Sometimes people try to lump all religions together.
Well, that's what I'm.
But let's be clear. Atheism is a faith-based philosophy. It is not science. Naturalism is faith-based philosophy. Materialism is faith-based philosophy. None of these are equal to science.
I agree with you.
Religions of their own.
Yeah, I agree with you, because they have their own faith system, things that they accept as true.
Solomon, an atheist, was following his religion when he killed all those people.
Right. Okay, John?
Yeah, he will point out the atrocities done in the name of Christianity. Of course, it's a distortion of Christianity. It contradicts biblical morality. These things like the Inquisition and some of the things that the book says, et cetera, those contradict biblical statements.
That's it.
Plus, you want to go do the blame game. In all of history, the total fatalities due to religious-based, quote, wars, I think is under 1 million people, I think, on that. But let's look at the atheist, Stalin, 5 million people.
Hitler.
Mao Tse-tung, 35.
The killing fields in Cambodia.
People.
The Holocaust.
The Holocaust, which was not religiously based. Hitler was not a Christian.
Okay, I want to.
I just quoted 100 million people within 50 years.
Okay, here's what it comes down to. This may sound a little bit like I'm trying to make an excuse for this, but think about what I'm saying. You cannot judge Christianity by how Christians behave. You have to judge Christianity by what the Bible says about how we're supposed to behave. That's the ideal. That's what we're supposed to be headed towards. As Christians, we have really messed that up a lot of times in history. But that doesn't mean that the faith is wrong, because look at what we're headed for. It's like if you're a Republican and you believe in Republican conservative ideals, if you mess it up, it doesn't mean the ideals are wrong. It means that you messed it up. Alan.
Actually, I have one quick question, but I got to go to work, so you're doing a great job. It's nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Well, I take back what I said about you then.
I wanted that, the sanctity of life and all this. What about God when God, it seemed kind of a contradiction when God told Moses when they wandered through the, you know, before they got to Canaan, which was the name at that time, I think he said kill everything. Kill, because they were evil. Kill every human being, babies, women, children.
But at that time, Alan, there were cultures that were entirely reprobate. God is not going to order someone to be killed who still has a chance of accepting him or allowing him to change their life. They were past the point of no return. He knew that. And now, because of the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, since Jesus, like you've heard Hugh say, there are no societies which are entirely reprobate. So God doesn't go around taking out whole populations anymore. It's a different time. Right. Okay. Well, I want to
say something with the original Bible.
Okay.
Apocalypse. That only the wise nations will say, no, that matches God's requirement. That's it. We have to be honest with ourselves. If we as Christians, we are not honest.
Can we do this? This is not part of what I'm talking about. So
it's not
okay,
bad.
Okay.
It
I've got 14 minutes left.
We
so
have not done mistakes will not be solved. That's what I
okay.
We have to be honest with us.
There's a couple of John. You've had your hand up for a day.
One looks into Canaan culture, they discover the most gruesome forms of human sacrifice and worship of Moloch. Those people really
worship of Moloch.
A lot of the Jews are reprobate babies.
And also,
only one they went astray. With regard to the withdrawal of gold by Cortez, he actually took so much, it increased the gold supply in Europe and produced inflation. So that's just another lesson that whatever is used for money, if it's an excess supply, the prices will go up.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm probably not going to do any more questions because I've only got a few minutes left. Two more examples of things where Christians took the lead in doing something, but often handled it badly. Okay? The first was the elimination of slavery. Christians were the first people in history to oppose slavery on moral grounds. A lot of people opposed slavery because they didn't want to be enslaved, but it was okay to enslave someone else. They were the first ones that came along and said, this isn't right to do this for anybody ever, because everybody is made in the image of God. There's a certain dignity that we all have. Slavery is wrong under all circumstances. They are the first guys that did this. It started in the Western world, 18th century Britain. It went to the rest of Europe, then it came to the United States. One of the guys that started it in Britain was William Wilberforce. He was a member of Parliament. You guys, many of you have probably seen Amazing Grace, the movie. It treats it pretty well. After decades, he started a process. He tried to pass legislation every year in Parliament, and it was defeated. He finally was successful. He had no support, but he single-handedly, almost, defeated slavery in Great Britain. Finally, in 1833, the slave trade was abolished, even though slavery wasn't. But it's really easy to, historians ignore his Christian value system. So I want to read a quote by him, about why he did what he did, okay? Policy is not my principle, and I am not ashamed to say it. There is a principle above everything that is political. And when I reflect on the command that says, thou shalt do no murder, believing the authority to be divine, how can I dare set up any reasoning of my own against it? And, sir, when we think of eternity and of the future consequences of all human conduct, what is here in this life which should make any man contradict the principles of his own conscience, the principles of justice, the laws of religion, and of God? It's pretty clear why he did what he did. There's one more. The first, this is William Wilberforce again, noting he's talking about his faith. He says, the first doctrine which it inculcates is that of brotherly love. It commands goodwill toward all men. It enjoins us to love our neighbors as ourselves and to do unto all men as we would that they should do unto us. And how can any man fulfill this scheme of universal benevolence who reduces an unfortunate person against his will to these most insupportable of all human conditions, who considers him as his private property and treats him not as a brother nor as one of the same parentage as himself, but as an animal of the brute creation? There's really not a lot of question about why he did what he did. It was certainly not politically expedient. If you read about his life, he was privileged, he had money, he was born into a wealthy family, he could have been in Parliament and rode that out to a really nice retirement, but he got it in his heart that this was his mission from God, and was ostracized by a lot of people in the culture at that time. He took a lot of personal hits for doing what he did. But he ended slavery in Great Britain almost single-handedly because of his faith and his belief in the sanctity of life from the pages of the Bible. In the U.S., I don't have time to go into it, but the people who took up William Wilberforce's mantle in the United States were almost all Christians. Now, the downside is many, many, many American churches ignored the issue. They did not want to take it on. And that's where us being Christians, we have to bravely and courageously follow these values, do what Jesus would have done, or we're doing the same thing as the pagans. Al, this is what I want to read to you. This is Paul Johnson, a historian. A quote, Christianity was the one great religion which had always declared the diminution, if not the final elimination of slavery, to be meritorious. No real case for slavery could be constructed in good faith from the Christian scripture.
The scripture allows slavery.
No, it doesn't. It just describes. Al, it describes it. It describes it. It doesn't. It doesn't.
God created slavery. For example, if we
talk about please, please.
Noah's son, God says, you will be. Noah cursed. I mean, it was led by God. For example.
Okay. No, come on, please. I've only got 8 minutes. Don't take my time. Okay. I want to read this. This is a quote from historian Gilbert Barnes about the American abolitionist movement. He's this guy's a secular historian. He says, from the beginning, the movement had been inextricably bound up with the churches. The churches were its forums and the houses of its local organizations. From the churches, it drew its justifying inspiration. It was an aspect of the churches, non-sectarian in organization, but evangelical in character, a part of the benevolent empire. Everywhere in the organization, clergymen were in control. In every respect, the agitation was a moral movement, a religious movement, drawing its life from the churches. We don't learn that in school, where the motivation against slavery came from. It doesn't mean that people of goodwill who did not believe in God didn't fight against slavery. But the ultimate source of their revulsion against slavery is from the Bible, not from any other source. You can't reason your way into believing that all people are created equal. If you could, there would be plenty of places in human history where other people have come to this idea. And there aren't. If you leave people alone, they treat each other badly. They don't respect each other. They treat each other with a cheapness of life that we are revulsed by. Another one is the civil rights movement in this country just 50 years ago. A lot of us are old enough to remember what went on there. We were fighting for the civil rights of blacks and other minorities so that they would be treated equally under the law in this country. 50 years ago. Jesus lived 2,000 years ago, and yet we're still trying to figure this out. We're still trying to figure out what does it mean that we're made in the image of God. I want to read one quote by a couple of quotes by Martin Luther King. I got a whole bunch on this, but I don't have time to go into it. But Martin Luther King's taken a lot of hits. There's a lot of people who have said he was not that strong a Christian. There are people he wasn't a flawed man. There were things he did that were not good. But let me read a couple of things from his own words. This is an impromptu speech he gave when right at the beginning of the civil rights movement. So he didn't have time to think about this. This is how eloquent this guy was. We are not wrong in what we are doing. If we are wrong, the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. If we are wrong, the Constitution of the United States is wrong. If we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong. Jesus, if we are wrong, Jesus of Nazareth was merely a utopian dreamer that never came down to earth. And we are determined here in Montgomery to work and fight until justice runs down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. God, I cry when I read that. That guy is amazing. This is another quote that I want to read that he was describing himself at a really dark time in the movement. He said, with my head in my hands, I bowed over the kitchen table and prayed aloud. The words I spoke to God that midnight are still vivid in my memory. Lord, I'm down here trying to do what is right. But Lord, I must confess that I'm weak now. I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. Now I am afraid. And I can't let the people see me like this. Because if they see me weak and losing my courage, they will begin to get weak. The people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they too will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone. It seemed as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness, stand up for justice, stand up for truth. And lo, I will be with you even till the end of the world. I tell you, I've seen lightning flash. I've heard the thunder roar. I've felt sin breakers dashing, trying to conquer my soul. But I heard the voice of Jesus saying to fight on. He promised never to leave me alone. At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never experienced him before. Almost at once, my fears began to go. My uncertainty disappeared. I was ready to face anything. A remarkable statement. Most of the people who started the civil rights movement were ministers. Most of the black churches in this country supported that movement. Most of the white churches in this country ignored it for quite a while. And that's the black mark on us. That's where the white churches did not follow Jesus' teaching. We were not courageous. We were not doing what we were supposed to do. But here's another quote. Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's president, he maintained that the civil rights movement gave, quote, the Christian church its greatest opportunity in centuries to make religion real in the lives of men. So that's the motivation. Got a couple of minutes left. We cannot, we don't just stop there at this idea of equality. Again, it's taken us centuries to develop this idea, but if we really believe in the equality of all people, where does that lead us? It leads us to women's rights. It leads us to civil rights. Even the idea of adoption. Western civilization, especially the United States, adopts more babies per capita than any other culture in the world. Why is that? It's because if you don't really believe, like Jesus said, that all people are your brothers and sisters, why would you adopt somebody else's baby? What possible motivation would there be for doing that? So that the idea of adoption, that that's a good thing, is ultimately based in the teachings of the Bible. Now here's the one of the things that we are taught in this culture that to me is the most ironic is this idea of tolerance. We're supposed to tolerate, understand, respect other people's way of thinking, other people's religion. Jesus said, as much as is within you, live at peace with all men. Okay? That idea of tolerance that we have, that's written into our Constitution, that is part of the way that we think, is a Christian value. If you go to other cultures that have other belief systems, they do not tolerate. Okay? That, it's very interesting to me that that is a Christian value. It comes right out of the Bible. So I am to respect someone else's religion because of my Christian faith. It's a powerful thing. The idea of guilt orientation, rather than we talked about honor and shame. In an honor-shame culture, you only feel like you did the wrong thing if someone sees you do it. Okay? In our culture, we talk about doing the right thing no matter what anybody says. Do it because it's right. Well, what makes it right? The whole idea that there's something right by itself and wrong by itself is a Christian, Judeo-Christian concept. Before that, it was just, look, I'll take care of you, you take care of me, anybody tries to fight us, we'll fight them. And that's the way the world generally operates. So the idea that we have a guilty conscience, the idea that we feel bad about something we did, even if no one saw us do it, that's because we've internalized these Christian values, even for people who don't believe in God. That's the ultimate source of it. So there's a lot more I can say. It's 12:30, and next time I'm probably going to pick this up because there's a whole lot more to do on this, and I guess I'll open it up for a couple of questions. Big Jim.
I just wanted to say that during the civil rights movement, we always heard about Reverend Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hear that in the news today. We hear about Dr. Martin Luther King.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah.
Thank you all for saying that. He's a Judeo-Christian son of my life because the Bible consists of also the Pentateuch. So I just want to expand that.
It's easy to say Christian values, and I find myself saying it too, and I have to include the Old Testament because what Jesus taught, much of it was original, but its moral foundation is the Old Testament. And so we cannot ignore that. Al?
Yeah, let's not forget that, during the civil rights movement in the 60s, this was a Christian nation. 85% of Americans believe in God and the Bible and Christianity and all that, and they were still being denied their civil rights. Had to take a civil war, half a million people to die in this country to abolish slavery. And then it takes, then he came along and shamed America into doing the right thing.
For religious reasons.
So you might say, okay, that comes from the Bible. And mm-hmm.
You're admitting that. That's great.
But it's not just that. So I'm saying that. If there was these Christian morals would be so great, we'd all be perfect.
No, Al, I explained that. We all have the ability to choose to do wrong. I've done plenty of things that in my life that I knew were wrong when I did them.
What I'm saying,
I didn't follow.
Not the total answer.
No, a relationship with Jesus Christ is the total answer. We can't follow these values on ourselves. Okay, I want to close with two quotes. A lot of times people will say, okay, great, I admit these values came from the Bible, but now that we've got this figured out, we don't need the Bible anymore. That's not going to work. If we do that, we will fall backwards to where we were. Here's a quote by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Soviet dissident. If I were asked today to formulate as concisely as possible the main cause of the ruinous Russian Revolution that swallowed up some 60 million of our people, I could not put it more accurately than to repeat, quote, men have forgotten God. That's why all this has happened. And one more just to close. William Jennings Bryan, an American statesman, he said, if civilization is to be saved from the wreckage threatened by intelligence not consecrated by love, it must be saved by the moral code of the meek and lowly Nazarene. Thank you, everybody.